Yeah, my name's Jim Bach. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. My sobriety date is November 19th, 1987, and this is my home group. I have a sponsor, and what comes out of my mouth is not his fault. I'm not going to talk about sponsorship because my sponsor's here, and Clancy's here, and I'd rather not Clancy spend the next hour correcting me. I'd like to introduce our speaker, and who's a very active member of his home group and has helped a lot of alcoholics. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immersland. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here. The fourth anniversary of this meeting. I've been here to all the anniversaries, I guess. So it's a pleasure to be here and see some new faces and some old faces. I want to just mention briefly something none of you know, I'll bet. You're going to go home with a fact tonight. In 1939, before the book was published, a woman in New York was very pleased because her brother had gotten sober. He was a lawyer, got sober in AA. And she was visiting Los Angeles. And she somehow got a copy of the manuscript of the book before it was printed. And so she took it with her and she advertised in the Los Angeles Times, "Women, do you have husbands with a drinking problem? There's an answer." And she rented a little, she got some calls, and she rented a little room in a hotel up in the mezzanine. And on that Sunday, 12 women came in with 12 volunteers. So they met upstairs in this room and they said, "Okay," they said, "this woman, what are we supposed to do now?" She said, "I don't know. I'm not an alcoholic. I've never been in a meeting. I just brought the manuscript. Why don't you guys sit here and talk? We'll go out in the mezzanine." So they sat there and looked at each other. And, one of the guys, Morty Joseph, was a guy I met years later, stayed sober many years, but he was the only one with a shirt and tie on, so they had him be the chairman. So they said, "Why don't you read something out of that book?" So he went through the table of contents and found how it works. "Well, that'd be a good thing to read, I suppose." So he read that just the way you heard it tonight before it was edited into the big book. And that is where the custom of reading chapter 5 came from. And for many, many years, for 30 years, 25 years at least, only in California they read chapter 5, nowhere else. And little by little it went all over, now it's all over the world. But now you know something you didn't know. I want to thank Tom for an excellent talk on spirituality tonight. He really gets to the nitty gritty of it. Fine speaker, good amen. My job is, he talked about the spirituality, and I'm going to talk on materialism. I'm into the big bucks. No. I've been sober a long time. My sobriety date is October 31st, 1958. And I've been active all these years, and so as a result of that, I've had an opportunity to do some things that most people haven't had a chance to do yet. I've been asked to come and speak in exotic places like Cape Town, South Africa, and Johannesburg, and Berlin, and London, and Paris, and Oslo, and Australia, and other places. And I have been active throughout the United States and in Canada. And I am probably the only one in this room who had the opportunity to sit down and talk to Bill Wilson for an hour in 1963 when I was 5 years sober. I wish I remembered what he said. I could have really. I was more concerned with what he thought what I said. I could have been a contender. But AA is 70 years old now. Some of you young people here, I was talking to a couple of new guys tonight. One 2 months sober in the washroom just now. I had to elbow him out of the way from the mirror so I could get my look. And young man from New York brought some people down, some other guys. We had a nice chat. And sometimes you don't, I want to just put it in perspective just for about 2 minutes. You know, there seems to be two types of alcohol, or more than two perhaps, but there seems to be types of alcoholics. We never talk about it, but there are types of alcoholics. There seems to be a type of alcoholic that by any measurement is an alcoholic, and he drinks, he can't stop, but something happens that really threatens his security. And he loses his job, or loses his family, or a death in the family. And he quits! And he never drinks again. And there's a lot of people like this who have been able to stop drinking like that. These same people, if they become physically addicted to alcohol, which is much more difficult to get off of, to get sober from, they are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to medically withdraw people. You think, is it necessary? Withdrawal from addiction to alcohol is much more lethal than the withdrawal from drugs. Hard to realize that, but it really is. And these were, every step of the way, they show them the problems, what they've done in their life, and they see it, and they quit! And they never drink again. In fact, there's a hospital up in Seattle called Chic Shadel, very famous alcoholic hospital, and they advertise, "We will cure your alcoholism in 10 days. And they do. Because that type of alcoholic, when they get them sober and educated, they never drink again. They have a long list of successful graduates. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any measurement, and something drastic happens. They lose their family, they lose a job, somebody dies, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these same people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they quit! But they eventually always drink again. And these are the people that have baffled science and medicine and religion for 5,000 years in recorded history. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in this room who are familiar with that syndrome. Probably most of us, it's most personal to people like me, and I presume like you. Because I presume you're like that, or else you wouldn't be here tonight. You're seeing that terrible look of disappointment in someone who maybe you love, or who loves you. That terrible look. Oh, how could you? You were doing so well. And the children were feeling better, and now look at you. And it makes you feel so bad, you just have to shriek, "Shut up! Leave me alone!" Because it makes you feel so bad, you don't have to do. And these are the people for which there's never been any answer. And what's remarkable here, now we all know about AA. AA started in 1935. But you and I are living in the only window in 5,000 years where there's been alcoholics of our type, where there's a place to go. Now, Bill Wilson, when he wrote this book, didn't realize types of alcoholics. But you'll notice again and again in the book, he writes, alcoholics of our type, alcoholics of our type. And it's really a remarkable thing. And for this to be 70 years old, there was a brief movement in the early 1840s called the Washingtonians, where some drunks got together, and they tried to do what AA is doing, and they were much more successful than AA. In 5 years, they had 100,000 sober drunkards. But what they decided to do is help all sorts of people, and they all died drunk. Really sad, sad thing. So, AA's 70 years old now. It's the most successful treatment of alcoholism of our type ever in the history of the world. There's more sobriety in years in this room tonight than there was probably in the world in 1935 of alcoholics of our type. It's just remarkable. And it seems to be now that as I travel around and I talk to people, there are elements today who feel that it may be time to update AA to make it more effective, to make it more thorough. There are four or five little techniques that people are talking about around the country and around the world. One is that maybe we're being too exclusive, insisting that you be an alcoholic. Because with all the drug problems extant today, and most everybody at one time or another being on drugs, maybe we are being a little too specialized by telling them, you can't come here, you can't be a member, you must be an alcoholic. Because it's really all one big disease. The second thing they talk about now is that there's a feeling in many areas that we are trying to be doctors by telling people they can't take antidepressants, by telling people they can't take medications for their emotions and nerves. And who are we to tell people what to do? We are to deal with drinking. There's a really a big school of thought on that. A third one that people talk about now is the book. Good book, but really kind of written in an old-fashioned way. Maybe we should update it and make it more topical so that young people coming in today will read something that is more that will interest them to help them to find a way to do this. A fourth thing is there's several movements. There's one in Minneapolis recently, various places around the country, to get rid of the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is a great prayer, but it's too religious. It's keeping non-Christians out of AA in some places, keeping Jewish people and Muslims and agnostics and atheists out of AA. They have to say the Lord's Prayer. Why should we insist they say this Christian prayer? And the fifth thing they talk about is, what's that big deal about anonymity? Maybe once upon a time people had to be protected against their alcoholism, but not now. My God, it's almost a mark of distinction. You read in the paper every day, these movie stars that say I'm an alcoholic, and all over, celebrities say they're alcoholics. Who cares if I say I'm an alcoholic? If I can help somebody, if they know I'm an alcoholic, at the level of press, radio, and film, or television, why not do it to help someone? Now, these are all seem to be very valid points and arguments, and I just want to look at them a little bit to talk about it for those who are new, aren't familiar with these various things. That first one about being so exclusive, of keeping non-alcoholics out of AA, even though they may be drug addicts, because, as the saying goes, it's all one big disease. Alcoholism, overeating, drug addiction, gambling. It's all one big disease. Do you know where that phrase came from? It's all one big disease. It came from a treatment center that only had one van. Why would we insist on being an alcoholic to be an alcoholic status? And you have to, for that reason, you have to understand the nature of this illness. As I mentioned earlier, there's never been any answer for it. There still is answer because of the denial within people themselves, the patients. But one of the great breakthrough in the treatment of alcoholism is not information. There isn't a person in this room that hasn't had enough advice to last them 10,000 years. We just seem to draw advice like a magnet. You really should do something about that. And after a while, you just develop, like Reagan had this plan going to be able to shoot down incoming missiles. You can just shoot down incoming advice. And nod. Who cares? You don't understand. Of alcoholics of our type, probably the operative phrase is this: I know you mean well, but you don't understand. And that's what kills people like us all the time. So how do we overcome that? The only thing that has ever overcome that, and helped it with the Washingtonians for a while, and in AA, is that these are the only two therapies in the history of mankind that have been one drunkard talking to another drunkard. Now, what should be so good about one drunkard talking to another drunkard? Shouldn't a trained psychologist or a doctor or a minister be able to get through that wall of denial? Apparently not. The interesting thing about this concept is that this feeling of difference must somehow be addressed. It cannot be addressed unless I open my armor. I will never open my armor unless I get a hint that the person talking to me understands how I feel. The greatest gift any one of us will ever get in the treatment of alcoholism is finding someone who you believe knows how you feel. Some people go their whole life and never find such a person. I almost did. I slipped in and out of AA for 10 years. I was smarter than by that I knew around. And I went from being a high-bottom drunk to being a medium-bottom drunk to being a skid row drunk with my teeth kicked out and thrown up a low-grade mission. And the last day I stood in that street with my mouth bleeding and raining, someone said, "Are you an alcoholic?" I said, "No, I'm not." I have a lot of emotional problems, I have no question about that, but I'm not an alcoholic. Because I know what an alcoholic is. I've been with AA for years. An alcoholic is a person whose problem is alcohol. And they come to AA and admit it. And once they admit it, they start to feel better. They return to God. And they make some good actions. They feel better. And none of those things would be appropriate to me. Because my problem really isn't alcohol. It is when I'm drunk. But that's no problem. I've always known that I had problems. Since I was a boy, it seemed to me there was something missing in me. I don't know what it was, but when I get close to people, they don't seem to like me as well as they used to. I don't seem to fit in with the people I want to fit in with, and I feel clumsy and awkward when I'm around people I want to impress. And I just think when I grow up, it'll be different. And I grew up and it wasn't different. Just a different set of feelings, but always a little off. You're supposed to feel like this going through life. You know, for one, I was always feeling like this one reason or another. And when I was a boy and ran away from home early in the Second World War and hitchhiked from Wisconsin to San Francisco and lied my age and got in the Merchant Marine, my mother didn't know where I was. And on that ship, the first ship I was on, some old tough guys got me to drink some whiskey. And I was raised in such a religious home, I'd never been in the same room with a bottle of whiskey. And I took a drink of whiskey and I threw it up and they laughed at me, so I kept trying to drink it for days when nobody was around. I wanted them to think I was a man. And I finally held a drink down. We came into Pearl Harbor. I was watching the dig up ships around me. And that drink, terror tasted terrible. All of a sudden something strange happened. I would have never known it at the time because I was too dumb and young. But in retrospect, what alcohol does for me, it makes the scale go away. It's fine. It fills holes in me that the holes I don't know how to fill any other way. And I didn't become a crazy alcoholic or crazed or anything else. I ran around the war, got the Navy, and went up in the hospital at the end of the war, being sewed together, and they passed around some tests. I wasn't good on tests, so I did very well. They gave me a high school diploma, which I'm still a junior in high school. I went back to Wisconsin after the war, and I went to the University of Wisconsin, won some trophies for them. Got married around the world, became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer. But I'd made one mistake. I had married a Catholic. And she began manifesting Catholic behavior that little Lutherans like me don't understand. That is, they started burying young at a remarkable rate. And I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Well, I was a pretty good writer, and I got some good jobs in advertising and public relations. I'd get better jobs. And all these years I drank and raised hell, because that's what we did. And sometimes I drank too much, and people would think my problem was alcohol. I had no way to explain to them. I didn't understand it myself. One of the reasons I know I'm not an alcoholic. Alcoholics can't quit. I can quit anytime. I've quit so many times, it's ridiculous. My problem is not that I can't quit. But after I quit, sooner or later, sometimes the next day, sometimes a week, a few days, someone seems to sneak into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it comes out as just a little growing restlessness. Just a little irritability. Just a little discomfort. Just a little resentment toward these people giving me their damn lectures when I'm supporting them and keeping their company looking good. They treat me like a child. And I'm tired of it. And it mounts up and the tensions get intense. And sooner or later, I have a few drinks. I don't take drinks, I'm a drinker. But drinking is the only thing I know that breaks that tension. It makes me feel like it's something again. And then sometimes, even after that, I drink too much. And they say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? Yes, yeah, I guess it was. Ha, ha, ha. But inside your voice wants to shriek, but you don't understand. It wasn't that at all. If you people would just get off my back, I'd be all right. I drink too, I want to feel like I'm something. So I went to my first AA meeting in 1949, a long time ago. I was 22. I didn't know that there wasn't anybody in that state within 20 years of that. And a bunch of old fat guys sitting around the table said, what the hell are you supposed to be? I didn't know. I tried to be honest. I said, I don't know. They suggest I might want to come here. You think you're an alcoholic? I said, I really don't think I'm an alcoholic. Said, what the hell do you think's wrong with you? I try to be honest. I think I'm too sensitive. Ha ha ha! Let's go this one, Lemoyne. Ha 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 ha! I'll tell you one thing, I never said it again. Because the guy, I began to learn about, and I went to A from then on, off and on. After a while, I didn't go to A for any help because A was not very well known. I'd get in trouble drinking on a job. I'd go to the human resources people, say, I'm going to this new thing called A. Well, give me a little opportunity, give me a couple of weeks, elbow him, sure. At least it gives you a chance to look for a new job. And there wasn't any, you know, you go home and say to your wife, well, I've gone back to AA. Wonderful. What do they want you to do, honey? They want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for anybody. No, they don't. Let's stop it down. We know that. We have the same stuff you do. I release you, you son of a bitch. So I eventually became a low-bottom drunk, and as yet, so I Skid Row Mission in Los Angeles, and said, stay out of here, you mooch. That's right, I'm not a mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. Elmer ads for the board, and got me running that very week in Life and Time, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. But I would have bet my life there was no answer, because I knew, I'd read the book several times, I knew all about AA. I stood at the street corner, and it was raining, so I walked to an AA club to see if I could hustle some money, because when you look that bad, there's no place you can go. And what saved me of my life is because I was so desperate, I hung around there for a while, and I fell in the hands of a guy who really overcame my dislike of him and my distrust to convince me that he felt the way I did. And I never knew it at the time. I look back and I think, what a golden moment that was. I just remember thinking, oh, this guy feels the same way I do. Of course, how come he's doing so well? That's all. And that identification is such an important thing. As I say, if you're new tonight, or kind of new, I hope to God, if I could give you one wish from my heart, I hope you'll find someone that you believe knows how you feel. Because it will be essential for you to take actions you don't believe in. And you would have somebody you trust to believe that. Because ACT sponsors, you'll find when you get sponsors, especially if you're an obstreperous puke like me, sponsors tell you stupid things. Now, they don't say this, but it sounds like this. Clancy, you see that curtain? That's bright red. No, Bob. Not bright red, it's kind of a tan, isn't it? I tell you, it's bright red. It's tan. Well, goddammit, you act like it's red. Now, they don't tell you the color of curtains. That's too easy. But they tell you things equally stupid. I want you to apologize to that woman. You called her a bitch. She is a bitch, Bob. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. But she's absolutely right. You apologize. Sorry. Bitch. I don't care how it looks to you. You stay on that job. Jesus, Bob. I used to be a big shot. They got me stuffing envelopes for $1.07 an hour. It's demeaning. I'm not even making up to my rent, Bob. This is terrible. I don't care. You're lucky you got the job. Stay on there. I don't care how it looks to you. You go to that meeting Friday night. Jesus, Bob. Hello? There it is. Hello? Jesus calling. He said, I don't care. I said, Jesus, Bob, that meeting's a big clique. There's an in-group, and they don't call on people like me. They just sit around and tell each other how wonderful they're phonies and all hypocrites. He said, I don't care what you think. You go there. I said, Jesus, Bob, they treat you like a piece of crap. He said, maybe they're right. And you keep doing this again and again, and stupid things and stupid things and stupid things. And one day you turn around and the damn curtain is red. You have to spend the rest of your life dealing with dumbbells who think it's tan. But it turns out it's the actions here that change your perception. And that is why it is so essential to be an alcoholic. That is why people who are alcoholics and gamblers founded GA in 1958. I know the founder of GA very well, Jim. And he founded GA. And that became the first and most successful of all the non-AA 12-step programs. And he built it up. It's all over the world, especially in heavy gambling centers. By 1965, he was so active in GA, he hadn't been to AA for a while. Somebody was reading sad, but he got drunk and died. But he never gambled. And the way they remember, that's the way they remember in GA. Just as though we would say, well, Bill Wilson never drank again. He may have gambled. It depends on where your focus is. And then some guys in North Hollywood that I knew, 1959, who were narcotics addicts, founded Narcotics Anonymous, because they were also AAs, so that Narcotics Anonymous could provide identification to people who also were narcotics addicts and who were non-alcoholics. Some place to go and get identification. Identification is the number one product we have to get offered to a newcomer. That's why members of Woman I Knew founded OA in 1960, so that alcoholics, she was an alcoholic and an overeater, and she wanted a place where overeaters could go who weren't alcoholics. And then that's where we founded Cocaine Anonymous. I never really understood the difference. I mean, I always thought, well, it's all kind of one big thing, really, but it really isn't. I remember 1960, I was a couple of years sober. I was doing pretty good. Still didn't have any front teeth, but I learned to carry my lip like this. People just thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I was talking to one of the local groups in our little club there, and I was talking on obsessions. I've always been an authority on obsessions. Not the recovery from them, just the obsessions. And I gave a great talk on obsessions. This woman came up to her, she says, you know, we've just started a little group called Gamblers and Overeaters Anonymous over on Olympic Boulevard at Our Savior's Church over there. Could you come over and talk to our ladies Sunday on obsessions? They've never heard anything like this. She says, sure, baby. I weighed about 130, and I knew I'd give them inspiration. Going over there on Sunday, and about six or seven fat ladies sitting around the table, and I showed off my waist. Hi. I gave them a talk on obsessions. It was just wonderful. Sat down. And they seemed to like it. And then they had a little sharing session. And I couldn't believe my ears. The woman here said, she sent her husband down to the school in Long Beach to pick up their son on his 12th birthday, where he's going to school. And she made a special two-layer cake for them. And while he was gone, she took a little bite to make sure it was good. Then another little bite. By the time they got back, the cake was gone. She'd eaten the whole cake. Jesus. I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy, but I thought, you know, just have a piece of cake and let it go. Woman over here talking about eating ice cream. She ate ice cream and ice cream, and one bought some more ice cream and ice cream, and just ate ice cream and chocolate out of strawberries. I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I thought to myself, no wonder you're fat. Jesus. Woman over here is the worst of all. She said she ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she put her finger down her throat and puked it up so she could eat some more. And I thought to myself, you don't have to shake hands with me after the meeting. I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done it for drinking a lot. Oh, it's pretty early in the day. I don't want to be too drunk tonight. Now, what was the difference? Intellectually, I understood exactly what they were talking about. I just didn't identify with it. I didn't. It was just information, meaningless information. Interesting, but meaningless. Without identification, that's all you get here. That's why people who are not alcoholic cannot really help alcoholics. That's why psychiatrists and doctors and people, well-intentioned people, can't seem to get through to these people, because that feeling of difference. And that's the main reason that we always maintain you must be an alcoholic to be an AA. I have a, you know, you hear, I've been working with addicts for over 30 years. I'm not against addicts, certainly. But when I go to an AA meeting, I don't want to hear some guy get up there and talk about shooting up and sniffing up and all that stuff. I want to know how glib he is. I'd rather have some guy can barely talk to. Well, I really dragged myself into a lot of trouble, and I came here. I got a sponsor, and I'm somehow staying sober, but Jesus Christ is terrible. Thank you very much.
I know how you feel, baby.
That is why you must be, you can be an alcoholic and an addict. You can be an alcoholic and an overeater. You can be an alcoholic and a gambler. You can be an alcoholic and a cocaine addict. You can be an alcoholic and twist baby chicken's neck. We don't care, but you got to be an alcoholic. And that's one of the reasons they ask you to speak about drinking at an AA meeting. Not because it's better or worse than anything else, so that newcomer alcoholics can identify. Because if they don't, they won't last, I'll tell you. I think about myself. I have three of my daughters are turning 16 in AA this year. I was telling someone at the break, one of them is a judge. She comes home at Christmas and she says, Daddy, remember when we were little girls, you used to send us to our room? I said, sure, honey. She says, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I have no need to go to Albuquerque. But I have a grandson who's had a year in AA. I have a great-grandson who is not, he's two, I guess. I hope he's an alcoholic, because if he isn't, he's a spawn of the devil. I keep looking at the back of his neck, see if there's 666. I suspect he'll be an alcoholic, he'll be running our family. But when he walks into a room someday, I hope he will hear people talking about things. He'll say, oh my God, that's me. Not just some esoteric, glib information that is of no use whatsoever. That's what we got to remember. That's why it really is not one big disease. Maybe the recovery has aspects of similarity, but the identification must be by one talking to another. Now, they also talk about maybe we should stop being doctors around here, telling people not to take antidepressants. My God, the doctor has identified the man, for example, bipolar and needs this medication. Who in the hell are you not to tell him not to do it? And that's certainly true, except there's just a couple things that you want to remember. It's really unusual how there's been such an epidemic of bipolarism since in the last few years. It just worse than smallpox ever was, And one of the reasons for that, of course, and I don't mean to be cynical about this, but it's actually true, and people will tell you that. Insurance companies will not pay for the treatment of alcoholics in most places. They must have a mental illness to go with it, or a physical illness. And so they identify them as bipolar and shove them full of medications, and they seem to do well. And they go out in the world, they're fine. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is that nothing has been done about the underlying problem that makes them that way, which is what AA deals with. And secondly, even if it did, these antidepressants, almost every month in the newspaper, there's a new breakthrough on how lethal they are, because their tests were very for short-term basis, long-term basis. About 4 months ago, front page of the Times had a big article, teenage suicides of kids on antidepressants. Maybe you saw that. Long-term terrible depressions, because it turns out in the long-term use of them, they bring about terrible depressions and sometimes suicide, because they are designed for short-term use. But they are so powerful, people can't get off them. And if you find someone on some of this heavy stuff and they try to get off cold turkey, they can't. I mean, they go goofy. We're talking about in the car today, somebody's doing that. So what do you do? At least in my group, when people say I'm on antidepressants, I just go on the treatments, I'm on antidepressants, I agree for them to go to their doctor and see if we can't wean them off. That's what you got to do. You got to wean them off little by little. It's like coming off of some other terrible drug. You can't get them off quick. If they don't choose to do that, they say the doctor says I should have these, and I have to tell them I can't help you because I have no experience in ever dealing with anyone on antidepressants who stayed drunk, who stayed sober. And I have no experience in that at all. I think it is such a... People say, well, you shouldn't bring it up. Yes, you should bring it up because they are engaged in a potentially lethal practice. If I want to help them, I've got to at least point it out to them and suggest maybe there's something can be done. Now, I know there are a few cases of bipolarism, but I'll tell you what makes bipolarism so common, a diagnosis, because it has bipolarism describes the symptoms of early sobriety. Highs and lows, highs and lows. Oh, I found a new program. Oh, Jesus Christ. Any decent doctor here is going to say, this ambitious is sick. Around here we say, keep coming back. But that very condition is what AA is designed to help. That's what AA is about. It is designed to make you wonderful. It's designed to make you live in a world of reality without having to induce temporary psychosis through the use of alcohol or medication. When I got out of the Texas Insane Asylum in 1956, where I'd been for quite a while, I actually committed suicide. They brought me back to life so they could put me in the insane asylum. Thanks a lot, doctor, for Christ's sake. But I had heavy donate of Thorazine, which was the big thing then for people like me. And the doctor said, if you don't take these Thorazine the rest for the rest of your life, you're going to commit suicide again. And I took them and took them and just, you know, it really slows you down. And then my life went to hell. I couldn't afford them anymore, and so I even felt worse. Then when I got sober, I couldn't find anybody who'd lend me the money to buy some. Didn't have the prescription anymore. So I had to take the actions of AA that made them unnecessary. Because that's what AA is about. I stopped thinking about that. I like to go back to that doctor sometime and say, you know, I haven't had a medication since October 31st, 1958. Stronger than an aspirin. And but he meant well, and he really felt it was essential. But he did not understand the nature of alcoholism. And the nature of alcoholism is this. For alcoholics, alcohol is the treatment for the condition that they are prescribing for us. I mean, I drink alcohol to change my perception of reality, to change my relationship to the world around me, to make me taller and more self-contained and them smaller and less threatening. Come on, baby! I don't drink anything. Oh, I bet this will be good. And people like us who are used to drinking know how to handle alcohol. I was thinking about this recently, watching the traffic stops in Los Angeles at Christmas time, where they have surprise stops to try to catch drunken drivers. They're not trying to catch people like you and me, who know how to drive while they're drinking. They're trying to catch amateurs who are coming home from the office party. Oh, I hit the tree, yeah. While people like us have to sit behind them and say, hurry up there, we're in a hurry. I hope that AA never loses its intentions. I will never lose my intention to help people get off medication. And the last thing is the first thing I said. It disguises the nature of the problem. In AA, with pain, you get motivated to do things. Pain is the greatest, more motivating than love or anything. When it really hurts. A few years ago, a guy who put the flag on the moon, came to me and said, there's going to be a convocation of Russian astronauts and American astronauts at the Russian legation in France. And I'm going to go, and I'm supposed to bring a guest, but my wife and I are divorced, the children are gone, who could I possibly bring? Well, when we went to France, I did it for its own good, of course. We went over on the SST. No longer there, so you'll never be on it. But it's a wonderful, long, skinny plane, two plush seats on each side of the aisle. Up in the bulkhead, there's a little clock with one hand. You take off New York, and it goes to about 3 o'clock, and you circle around. Then you get over the ocean, and they get it moving. That clock goes all the way around, back up to 12. You're at the speed of sound now, and it keeps going. And you're up at 50,000 feet. The sky is black, and you can see the curvature of the earth. It's just and when you land, you figure, I hope we got good brakes on this sumbitch. We're going to be in Belgium or someplace. But it turns out they don't use any brakes on the SST any more than the brakes on the plane I landed on this afternoon. They just reverse the thrust of the jets. The same jets that push you this way now stop you. And I was thinking of that a few years ago, sitting on a plane, how nice that is. It suddenly stuck me. That's exactly what AA is about, in a sense. You and I, when we are sober, the nature of alcoholism is such, it eventually creates sufficient conflict that it becomes essential to drink or to sedate. However, if I can somehow find someone I trust enough to reverse the thrust of those jets, that same pain can get me to take actions I would never take on my own. It may make me write an inventory when I swore I'd never write an inventory. To make an amend to my father, a man I hated, because the pain is so intense, do that! And little by little, the actions change you. And that's why we have to have someone here, and that's why you don't, every one of us have come here feeling terminally different. That does not make you different. That makes you just like everybody else. I never thought of it that way before. I had to write that down. There's some talk about the Lord's Prayer. People don't like the Lord's Prayer. It's too religious. It's really kind of funny. They say, well, we should only say the Serenity Prayer. That isn't religious. I don't know if anybody's ever seen the Serenity Prayer is four lines out of a long poem by a man named Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a theologian in the 1930s. And he printed this as the most religious, unstoppable, hideous religious thing if you don't like religion. I just read it. It was really more religious than anything. Now the Lord's Prayer, what is so difficult about the Lord's Prayer? They say, well, it keeps people out, keeps Jewish people out of the AA. I don't think so. My home group in Los Angeles, largest group in the world, I guess, some 1,000 people meet every Wednesday night. Some of you have been there, Pacific group. We meet in enormous synagogues. That's the largest place we can find to meet. And sometimes the rabbi comes in and sits down in the back. He told me, he said, I'm trying to figure a way to get this many people to my services. And I noticed when we say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting, he says it too. Now, it doesn't offend the teacher of the Jewish people. Why would it offend some boob coming along? You see? Or it offends the atheist. Who cares, for Christ's sake? You better learn, you got to do things you don't like around here, bud. Bill Wilson wrote a letter on this subject in 1959. He said, the worst thing atheists have to do, they don't have to say it, they can just sit and be quiet and listen, and probably it'll be good for their tolerance. You know? If the worst thing you have to do is say a prayer you don't really like, that is anywhere near, I'm only going to do things I want to do, then I'm not going to write an inventory. I'm not going to make amends. I'm not going to do anything I don't like to do. And you're going to get drunk and come back and not do it again until you are willing to become more flexible. And most people are like that. Here's just a sad little fact. There's sobriety, as I say, all over the world. The most sobriety is the United States. There isn't a town with more than 2 traffic lights that doesn't have an AA meeting. All over, you go anywhere, there's sobriety everywhere. It's no longer necessary to die from alcoholism, no longer necessary to go insane. And yet the National Institute of Health, the most recent numbers indicate alcoholics of our type, this problem alcoholic, in America today, something over 90% of us still die drunk or as a result of drinking. A number of people in this room tonight will die drunk. Maybe me, maybe you, I don't know. I mean, the man who taught me that, but my sponsor, later on he got mad at AA and stopped going to AA and got drunk and died. That certainly put an exclamation point on for me. It's not the not that you're bad, or because it isn't. You have to do bad things to get drunk. You just have to stop taking the corrective. It's like going to a diabetic and saying, you don't have to eat a lot of sugar to get the eye from out drug. Just stop taking your insulin. That'll go. That's what we do here. It's hard to remember. This is not a critical disease like pneumonia. This is a chronic disease like diabetes. In 1935, or 1945, Bill Wilson started the Grapevine as an effort to keep people together. One of the first articles in it was written by a non-alcoholic, Dr. Silkworth, probably the only non-alcoholic I know that ever wrote an article. He was Dr. Bill's, or Bill's sponsor, or Bill's doctor. He wrote an article on slips. He said, you alcoholics make such a big deal about slips as though God is punishing you. That's not it at all. We see it in medicine all the time. We find someone with a severe heart attack. We get them through that. We get them healed again. We give them a regime to follow, mild exercise, eat these foods, get your sleep, do these things, and they flourish. But after a while, they feel so good that it isn't really necessary to do these things anymore. And then they have a little start their eating habits, and I don't get much rest anymore. It's time to make up for lost time, and I don't do my exercise. We don't have time, and they don't ever go over here. They go like this. And one day they're over here, and down they go. So same thing with diabetics. We get them through the crisis. We replenish their lives. We give them a regime to follow. Take your insulin. And those times you had to be shot by it. I said, I'll do with pills many times, but take your shots of insulin every day. Don't eat these foods. Eat these foods. Get your rest. Do these things. And they flourish. But they feel good after a while. I really shouldn't have to, wouldn't hurt to have just a little bit off my med. And a little bit. And I don't really, oh, I missed my insulin, but I'm still feeling good. What the hell? No big deal. So that's all that happens to alcoholics. You come through your sickness, you're on your feet, you get a regime to follow, meetings, trying to help others, getting out of self, trying to straighten out your life, and you flourish. But after a while, just, you know, just the little things. I don't need meetings quite so much anymore. And I really use time. I take care of the real world. And I, God, I haven't prayed in a long time, but God knows I'm, you know. And I don't really, when people, I wish people wouldn't call me. I really don't have time for their sad stories. And one day they're over there and down they go. I say, how could that happen? What terrible thing did he do to get a slip? Didn't do anything terrible. He just didn't take the remedial actions that we have to take. That's why it's so important here to remember that we have to take remedial actions, and you don't have to understand them. You just have to take them. And that's why this, I think, such a big furor about this Lord's Prayer. Who cares why or how? Nobody says the Lord's Prayer because they understand Jesus told it to his disciples. It's a prayer that began with the beginning of AA because they took it from the Oxford Movement, and A's were the first in the Oxford Movement. They said they've been saying the Lord's Prayer ever since. Big deal. And they talk about the book. It is a nice book, but it is really, some of the phraseology is pretty old-fashioned, little, you know, a little square for hip, slick people like us. Hey, baby! And they act as though the book is something to be entertained and read, and it really isn't. The book is described, it's always, but I heard it described when I was new even. This book is a miracle. One of the problems in AA, there's always some fool who calls things miracles. You know, I got up early this morning. I looked in the eastern sky, and the sun was rising. And I says, God has given me another day. It's a miracle. Get up early tomorrow, Slim, and have another one. Jesus. Miracles are supposed to be things that are inexplicable or not explainable. They have to be things that are not explainable. And this guy, 3 years sober, sat down and wrote this book. Now, if you're new, you might think, 3 years sober? Gee, you should know enough to write a book by then. But even if you're 3 years sober, you'll realize you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're 5 years sober, You just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. You're coming back, Jimmy. You're doing a good job. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. But that one cream and two sugars, or two creams, never mind, I'll get it myself. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. And this goof of a guy, surrounded by failure, most of the early sobriety guys all went down. All went down. In fact, if you ever see the first printing of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that wonderful book, in the back there's the first stories. Most of them died drunk. Most of them had the stories in the second issue about died drunk. Not because they were bad people, they didn't realize they had to keep doing it. But anyway, he wrote this book, and he was surrounded by failure. Very few people staying sober compared to the people they were working on. He had no background in medicine or psychology or abnormal psychology or psychiatry, nothing. Just observed behavior as best as he could tell. And he wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 66 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That is a miracle. Now, maybe the book should be changed. Why would it be changed? Well, because the phraseology is a little off. But the book is not written as a phraseology primer. It is written to deal with human emotions that haven't changed in 5,000 years. I'll tell you, you think your emotions are different? When you get angry, that's the way the Pharaoh of Egypt got angry. When you find her, every other fool in the world has had the same feeling. And when you reach, probably the most sinister word known to any sponsor is that hideous word, relationship. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. If you're lucky, you have a thing on your desk that says, just put the foot on it and walk. Oh, but this one I know is different. I thought the last one was, but God, when I saw this girl walking out of detox. We were having lunch today, and we reached for the salt, and our fingers touched. And I swear there was a spark. There was a spark! I could read. Oh, God. And you hit that tub, kid. This is just part of the road. You have the 1 in a billion chance that you and this girl stay together. Maybe 3 years from now, you have your own little cottage with a little white gate. And maybe you have a tousled little child playing in the front yard. And you two will be having lunch. And you'll reach for the salt, and your fingers will touch, and you'll say, "Give me the goddamn salt." Those are just basic human emotions. And this book deals with emotions. Now, there's a school of thought in America today that I don't personally agree with. That makes no difference. But they study the book and memorize it and write about what it says and write paragraphs about what it says and on and on. It's ridiculous because as far as I can see, the book is primarily a cookbook. It is designed to spiritually feed us, to give us actions to take that will change our lives. And studying it and reading it is like studying and reading a cookbook. Oh, God, this is wonderful. I'm going to memorize this. I'm dying of starvation. I can't help that. Yeah. It deals with action. There's no place in AA that is more basic that deals with action than the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It has adjoining literature that we have, but every good AA you will ever meet will suggest you read the big book and practice it. I don't know anyone who ever does, and we all are averse to it. I remember when I first got sober in 1949, I realized, what a dull book. They always say it's badly written, it's just dull. Some years later, when I came off Skid Row, my new sponsor gave me this book to read, and I read that, and you know what I thought? This is really a dull book. I mean, I'd made a living writing things like, "Do it now! Take this action! Here we go! Out of there!" Nothing that in this book. You know. If you are thorough about this stage of your development. But another miracle of that damn book is this. It gets smarter every year.
Yeah.
Every year you stay sober. I've been sober 46 years, and I read once in August for a book study group, and I've been doing it for 25 years. And I never read yet. I read for a whole month. I don't find something saying, geez, I didn't notice that before. This really is getting, this book, somebody's been sneaking wisdom in here when I was looking. But that's why we don't change the book. They want to, now they've, 2 years ago, our delegates from around the world, and last year, took up the subject, shall we change the big book? And thank God, the answer was no. They just confined themselves to changing the stories in the back and revising them. But unless you and I always hope that 164 pages will ever change, because we don't know what makes it work. We may change the thing that makes it work. It's a wonderful thing. The last thing that seems to be on the plate of a lot of people is anonymity. What's the big deal about anonymity? My God, the people all over the world who are famous in AA, and we, you know, what's the big deal? Well, it would seem that way, because, you know, in the early days, they tried to protect themselves against, but over the years, they don't need protection anymore. Now, why would people not break their anonymity? I know when I got new, when I was new, my sponsor was telling me, you should never break your anonymity. I thought, yeah, yeah. There was a book just out, young people won't remember, maybe old people will, called I'll Cry Tomorrow by a woman named Lillian Roth, a famous singer. And they said, you should mention you're an AA in there. She said, oh no, I will help all kinds of people who are doing this. And so she wrote in there, and they made a movie with Susan Hayward playing her. And she said, I'm going to help a lot of people by letting them know I'm an AA. A couple years later, when she's laying face down drunk in Palm Springs in her own vomit, I don't know who she helped then, it destroyed her. But at the same time, John Barrymore, a big famous actor, his daughter named Diana Barrymore, wrote a book called Too Much Too Soon. And they said, you shouldn't mention AA, Diana. Oh, yes, I should. I don't help me. She wrote it in, she carried it a step further. She says, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. It has helped me so much to understand my problems, I can now drink wine with dinner. And when she died drunk in the Malibu jail, I guess nobody paid attention. But I've watched people break their anonymity off and on. Probably one of the more funny ones, not funny, funny, sad, not funny. In the year 2000, if any of you remember, I don't know if you saw this or not, there was a one-hour program on A&E that dealt with AA. And they had AAs, four AAs from around the country, talked to. All of them, you couldn't see their face, because that's what anonymity is. I was the one in Los Angeles. Perhaps now you recognize me. But on that program, too, there was a woman who, to show the other side of the coin, she'd written a book called Rational Recovery, proving that alcoholics can drink if you do it correctly. She said, I was an AA, and I don't mind breaking my anonymity, and this book will work for alcoholics. And it means, you know, she did the tape for that in January. When the program filmed in June, they didn't put it in there, but it came out a little later. She was already in the Washington State Penitentiary for vehicular homicide. She killed a couple people in the crosswalk while drunk. It didn't work that day for her. The last thing she said was, I'm going back to AA when I get out. I wanted to send her a telegram saying, oh, we're just sick with happiness, you. But some of you may not know what anonymity means. Anonymity, because of the nature of my work, and because I've been around all the time, I get interviewed a lot, because I'm kind of a semi-authority on alcoholism, not really, but I'm on television, I'm on newspapers, and, you know, on a biography, you talk about Spencer Tracy's alcoholism, and so on, and I say I'm a recovered alcoholic. You say, you broke your anonymity. No, I didn't, because I'm a recovered alcoholic. Article in Reader's Digest a few years ago about me, 6 pages. I said I'm now a recovered alcoholic. That doesn't make my anonymity. It's when I say I'm a member of AA. I can say I'm a recovered alcoholic all day long without any fear. But once I say I'm an AA, you must no longer see my face or know my name. I must not use AA for my own self-aggrandizement. Now, why would that be? At first, it was protection. But over the years, it's evolved into something else. It's evolved into a spiritual principle, a very, very important one. You know, you see these movie stars. Oh, yes, I'm an AA. They don't show them 2 weeks from now and they're drunk again. The only sober alcoholics in the movie community are people you don't know who they are. I know some of them, and I know, because I know all of them that are sober. But the guys who say they're sober aren't. It's kind of sad. Now, why would that be? What's the spiritual perception? The spiritual concept is this. It's the submission of self to the overall action of Alcoholics Anonymous. The last letter Bill Wilson wrote before he died in January of 1971. The last thing he wrote was a letter talking about we must maintain our principle of personal anonymity for the spiritual values it brings to us. I have never seen anyone break their anonymity and profit from it. You know, why would that be? Some kind of mysterious punishment by God? No, I don't think so. I think what it really boils down to, as far as I can see, is that when I say, look, everyone, I'm an AA, and that will help these people. I am now putting myself in a situation above AA. I'm now helping AA. And when I submit myself to AA, I submit myself underneath it, in the tent, in the spiritual confines of Alcoholics Anonymous to the ultimate good. It is kind of interesting, you know, Bill Wilson was having a great deal of difficulty in 1945 because AA was coming apart, and he wrote the Traditions to try to save it. And we hear them from time to time in meetings. If you ever want to read the real Traditions, read them in the back of the book. Across in the short form is the long form, which is really what the Traditions are about. In our home group, we read them once a month. Just all the newcomers will know what it's about. And it's an interesting thing. At the end, he writes something very interesting. But you look over this whole, because it deals with this whole concept of things you were talking about. We don't have to change. We've got the most successful thing in the world. What we have to do is continue to try to bring a message to people so they can get some identification for God's sakes and believe that somebody may know how they feel for the first time in their life. And we don't have to change the book, and we can say the Lord's Prayer. We don't have to hesitate about at least suggesting to people, maybe you'd like to get off your medications. Maybe they're not good for you after a while. And anonymity, maybe you have to maintain your anonymity. Because at the end of the 12th tradition, he writes about anonymity, but it really covers everything we talk about. The last phrase of the long form of the 12th tradition says, this to the end, that our great blessings shall never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. And the longer you stay here, and the more active you become, and the better you feel, little by little, it'll become overpowering. If it works, don't fix it. It's the best thing that's ever happened to people like us. All we have to do is remember to be grateful that we're living in a time when it exists. This to the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing, Clancy. We have a nice day of closing. Oh, thank you everybody for coming.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation.
anything for someone?
No, if you come back to our group, we'll be giving them out for free.